It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Oh, I'm here. Oh, let me push the button. Push the button. And we'll push the button later. Hello. Sorry about that. I mean, you're in the line at Starbucks. Go. We got a great show for you, of course, today. Pushing all the buttons, getting everything all set up. You know, the one thing that I want to do is I want to make sure that we have a conversation about the future. This is one thing that's going to be, I mean, it's coming whether we want to or not. The one thing that I want to make sure that we have is an understanding of just how fast this whole thing is going to unwind. And there's only thing that's going to be left at the end is going to be principle. The only thing that you're going to have at the end of this entire drama that's going to be played out is an understanding of what's happened in history. You have no idea what to expect in the future except by what has happened in the past. That my only roadmap into the future is what's happened in the past. Yesterday afternoon we had on Charles Goyette, the author of The Dollar Meltdown, and that's the one thing that we discussed, I wanted to make sure that we got in, is that, you know, this has happened before, hasn't it? Yes, it has. But what happened last time? Well, it went through this. And you always have a remnant, a core. There was an article, it was called Isaiah's Job, written by Albert Nock back in, heck, I don't know, at least 80 years ago or so. But it was very simple, and he's talking about Isaiah the prophet was told by God to, you know, go preach to the choir. Go get them all consolidated, get them all ready, we're going to need them. And he's like, no, man, I don't want to do that. I go off in the mountains and trying to hide from God, you know, good luck. And he's like, nope, get your butt back there. I insist. What he asked him to do is he wanted to, you know, there's more people than you realize. You just need to bring them together. There's a core that always remains after the most tyrannical times of all. There's always somebody that understands that, you know, what it's really about. Individual liberty, freedom. You know, those that won't leave me alone, bad guys. What happens is as times get worse, as the pendulum swings, as the world turns, you'll eventually always go back to core fundamental, I'm a human being principles. What's been keeping that in line over the last few decades, at least, has been libertarian philosophy, which is old. I mean, it's been around for, those just want to be left alone, those won't leave them alone. I mean, you know, it's really not that complicated. But what happens is, it's been articulated in such a way that you can apply almost any issue to it. It's not just, it's not a political thing as much as it's a way of life thing. If you're going to have delegated authority to someone, which is a whole other question, whether you want to do that or not, you know, what limits do you put on them? What's the role that they have? And how has it played out in American politics? Mary Ruart is a Libertarian National Committee member. She's run for president of, you know, for the nomination at the Libertarian Party conventions. And she's a prominent libertarian, wrote the book literally, and she's going to help us with the history of the libertarian movement. This is stuff you need to know. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
The world on my shoulder. As I'm getting older, your people get colder. Most of us only care about money making. Selfishness got us following the wrong direction. Wrong information always shown by the media. Negative images is the main criteria. Infecting the young minds faster than bacteria. Kids wanna act like what they see in the cinema. Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling under. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling down. It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive till love is found. Now ask yourself,
where is the love? Where is the
love? Oh, the love's right here. On Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, from the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com here in Phoenix, Arizona. On the line I have Dr. PhD Mary Rue Art, a wonderful humanitarian and representative of all that is holy in the Libertarian Party. Mary, I got you there?
Yes, you sure do, Ernie.
You know, the one thing that I wanted to do today, this is the conversation I wanted to have. And that was a perfect song, you know, to intro you, because Mary has always represented the love. What about the love? Where's the love? Because you have the there's two sides inside the Libertarian Party. Libertarian movement's different. Libertarian movement is much more generally oriented towards, you know, freedom's answer, what's the freaking question? But there is those that, you know, have a greater affinity towards the right. They want economic freedoms, and they're willing to kind of, you know, bend on a bunch of other stuff as long as they get to keep their money so that they can afford to tell other people how to live their personal life. And then you have people that just want to be left alone, and they're like, yeah, if you're going to go tax them, whatever, I'm not so concerned about, just leave me alone, and I don't have any money anyway. Well, libertarian philosophy is more open to, I just want my freedom in every aspect of life. But there's always a battle. Every election cycle and convention, there is this battle between, oh, you lefty libertarian, oh, you righty libertarian, as opposed to just being libertarian. And the one thing that Mary did, she wrote a book called Healing Our World. And it's more from a how would you define that? You know, they're always wanting to put you in blocks. I mean, did you ever consider it to be, you know, a left or a right thing or a true thing? Healing Our World, you're motivated to write that because of why?
Well, I had a day when I was reading about our foreign policy, and all of a sudden I had what I guess would be most best described as revelation. It just, what happened is things came together in a different way than they had before, and I saw that libertarianism was beyond what we've just been talking about. It was beyond just getting left alone, that it was actually about love. It was about loving your neighbor as yourself. And so what I was seeing is that a lot of the ways we presented the libertarian philosophy just didn't ring true with some people because it wasn't at the highest level it could be. And there may even be other levels. I suspect there are. But at this level, what I saw was that there's a very strong love component to our philosophy, because if we really don't want people to aggress against others, they're always going to be tempted if they think they get something by aggressing against others. That's why we have the situation we have today. But when there's a recognition that in aggressing against others, we aggress against ourselves at a very fundamental level, we stop doing it. And that was the, you know, the change in the way I started to view our philosophy, and I wanted to share that with people because it was so uplifting. What it meant is that we couldn't have the ends justifying the means, because the means that we used created the ends we got. If we weren't loving, if we were aggressive instead, then all the things we were trying to do, all the supposedly good things, like helping the poor or saving the whales or whatever we did, if we did it through aggression, it backfired every time.
You know, there was a paper done by a very good friend of mine, as Kent and Fran Van Cleve are good friends of mine. He's going for his PhD in Indiana right now, and she's a pharmacist, and a science fiction novelist. And, you know, he used to edit the Mensa newsletter, so the boy's got some, you know, brain cells. And one thing that he did, I think it was his master's that he did here when he was in Arizona, and he wrote the paper on freedom being a fundamental component of all life. And the point that he was making was, you know, the one thing that any organism wants to do is just to keep going on. You know, they want to keep replicating. They want to keep breathing in and out. I mean, you know, but what is the highest state and most productive way of existence that that provides? And certainly for sentient beings, he was trying to make the argument, and I think he did a really good job of explaining how freedom at its core is the most productive way of continuing to exist with voluntary associations with other organisms. Because if you use what you're saying, if you're using force, if you're initiating, if you're aggressing, you become everybody's enemy and they will exterminate you.
Exactly.
So it's in your own self-interest not to piss everybody off, you know, and that's where the love comes in. And so he's making a rational argument for not creating anger and animosity and aggression against everyone else, because it makes you a target. And it's just so that was one aspect of it. I mean, there was many others, but he was trying to get it down to, you know, organic molecular level. I mean, you know, that all organisms do this. You know, they need to replicate, but they find an equilibrium within their environment. But humans have a bunch of other humans, and we're in a situation where we're going to find out. You go messing with people, sooner or later they set the six pack down, get off their couch, and they're not going to sit down again until they're done. Once you get that inertia going, once they start, you know, the pitchforks and torches, you know, what do they do? They go, oh well, you know, I did it one day, and I'm going to put my pitchfork back down. I don't think so. Once this gets going, you know, there's no stopping the movement of the people, the yearning to be free kind of thing. And I'm going, all right, well, if we're going to have a philosophy that espouses this love of thy neighbor, and the biggest, highest expression of love is, I don't know, when we say revolution, we say it with love. I mean, we want to have a worldwide global love-olution. And you look for someone that's advocated that in detail, using libertarian philosophy to champion the idea that love is an asset. It is a tool. It is a way of living. It is a beneficial path to go on. It's just a bastardized what that means. I love you so much, I'm going to take my M1 tank and give you democracy because I love you so much. And I'm going, are you using aggression like you're saying? So I wanted to get in, and we got plenty of time today. We'll walk it through. But I want the history. You know, I want to get that. This is one thing that I do not know. And I talk to a lot of libertarians that have been around for a long time. And one of the founders of the party, David Nolan, is running for U.S. Senate against McCain here in Arizona. So he has his version of, you know, what's going on. And I've been around, you know, 20 years. So I kind of got my version. But you've been around longer. So I want to get, you know, ask you some detailed questions. You were prompted to write this book. In 1992, you were Libertarian Party vice presidential candidate. You know, you went for the nomination then. Mm-hmm. And were you vice presidential candidate then?
No. Nancy Lord beat me out for it. And
Nancy,
it worked out very well because had I had the nomination and been out campaigning, I probably wouldn't have been able to be with my sister Marty, who helped me write Healing Our World and who had cancer, terminal cancer. And I was her caregiver for that time.
Well, you're a pharmaceutical research scientist. I mean, I remember Dr. Ron Paul had advocated that you become head of the FDA.
Yes.
Hopefully to eliminate it.
Yes, he wrote me a letter of recommendation when that position was being reassigned, and my hope was that I could do a de facto privatization of it. There's ways to do it. And Ted Kennedy said he would not consider anyone from the pharmaceutical industry because he felt then the industry would get preferential treatment. They ended up hiring a veterinary-type person, and I heard him speak at one of our pharmaceutical conferences, and he just didn't understand why it took 15 years to get a product from the bench to the market. And he said, gee, we only take like a year or two to approve it. I don't understand why it takes so long. Well, of course, the companies spend, you know, 13 to 15 years getting the packet ready for the FDA to review, and we send literally truckloads of data, because they're all mandated by the FDA, to the FDA to review. So it takes them a year or two to read it. And it's just amazing that somebody in that position would not understand how the FDA has added 10 years to the drug development time.
You know, we have, let me see how much time we got. We got about 30 seconds. And I wanted to, we go into the next set. We got plenty of time. And while I'm thinking about it, I want to talk about this healthcare bill, but we're going to get to it eventually. Now's a good time. In the next 7 minute segment, I want to ask you some questions about these kinds of regulations and what it's going to create. Are we going to have hospital ships 12 miles out off the West Coast? Oh, the freedom always rears its head. We'll talk about it when we come back.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Power right here on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and another power-wielding individual, Dr. Mary Ruar, Ph.D. in love. You know, are you a love Ph.D.? Is that what they call you?
I haven't ever heard that expression.
I like it. We'll use it more. You know, the one thing that I wanted to get into, we were talking about, you know, healthcare was a big thing for a long time. And what made me think, I go, you know, people are not going to be allowed to suffer by other people, certainly when there's money to be made. So I'm thinking, I'm going, you know, why can't we have a, you know, hospital freedom ship 12 miles out off the coast? Just, you know, take your little, you know, half hour speedboat ride over to us, and we can have gambling and brothels and facelift surgery and hip replacement at the low, low, low price of whatever the market will bear. I mean, you know, you want to get away from all of this regulation and control and this, you know, 30s Germany, who gets to whatever Obama gets to say. You know, how come we can't just do it on a ship?
Well, actually, that's been proposed, and I think you'll see more of solutions like that. I mean, we're already seeing what we call medical tourism. You know, people here who can't afford their surgeries fly to India first class, get their surgery done, and come back, and it's cheaper than if they had it done here. And actually, if you go to socialized medicine countries like Canada with your Visa or MasterCard, you can be first in line while the Canadians wait. You know, Canadians wait on average a couple years for heart bypasses and things like that, and so they come here to get it done. And my sister works in an office in Michigan where they come in for hip replacements because they don't want to wait in pain so long. This is what we're going to be seeing more and more of when we actually go to full-fledged socialized medicine. And it's going to be the seniors who suffer the most, because the doctors have to do some kind of triage. So what they do is, for example, in Britain, if you are a kidney dialysis patient, which means that you need the dialysis to save your life, if you're over 50, you have a chance of being turned down, about a 1 in 3 chance of being just told, we don't have enough facilities for you. And that's what we're going to start experiencing here.
Wow. I can't imagine the health tourism not taking to the ocean. It just boggles the mind that you have such an enormous pent-up demand that's going to be created, and for some reason it not manifests itself right off the coast of one of the most populous areas in the world, the west coast of the United States. And there's an enormous market there, and just come on down. You know what? And we got, you know, foot masseuse that will be there 24/7, you know, while you're recuperating. I mean, you know, I don't see that not happening. But I'm wondering, what do you think the actions would be of the government? You sending out Coast Guard cutters and submarines and torpedo and hospital ships, you know, with their, you know, penthouse brothel on it? I mean, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I'm not always a very good predictor, but I would expect they wouldn't do too much. They're going to be mostly concerned with keeping things running the way they want at home, and 12 miles out or whatever it is for international waters, they'll probably leave it alone. In fact, they may be, you know, the government officials may be some of the people who need that service the most if they can't get to the front of the line. So, you know,
I anticipate that. I mean, if I was a gazillionaire, you know, I'd be looking at Freedom is popular, and I'm, you know, it's probably going to go to the West Coast because they haven't spilled oil there yet. So I'm, you know, looking at an opportunity to create on whatever the demand is, and you have people that will go, yeah, I want to go be free so I can go smoke and shoot up whatever. Well, do I really got to travel, you know, across the ocean to go there? Yeah, probably not. I need, you know, my brothel, my gambling, my whatever, you know, that is, you know, it's kind of a vice. It's, you know, it's your own personal little whatever. And it's maybe not as motivational to go do that unless you're wealthy. But when you need a transplant, when you know, your very life is at stake, I'm motivated, man. Get me on the boat and let's go take care of business. And they have that out there. And then, of course, once you have the freedom for that, it's going to have what, man, it's going to be resort de la naked sunbathing all over the place. I want to show off my scar. So I can see that coming. And because that is so certain in my head, there has to be a counter. It's like the Puritans. There's somebody somewhere being free.
That's right.
We got to go get them.
Yeah, and I've heard libertarians discussing this. In fact, Milton Friedman's grandson is actually promoting an effort towards something similar, although it's not a boat. It's more of a, I think it's a freestanding
city.
City in the ocean, yes. Yeah. So, there's a lot of talk about this kind of stuff.
I remember Oceania in the early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, they were going, I think it's like a 7-story hotel that floats over the Barrier Reef off Australia. And it's just like, I mean, if you want to be a skin diving individual, that's where you go. You just come up in the lobby. I mean, you know, this is amazing technology. It's been out there for decades. And they're just now starting to go, you know what? We could do this. But what's the economics? I mean, you don't have to buy land. I mean, that's one thing. Let's build this high rise and pay a gazillion $1 trillion. Heck, for that, you could build the dang city. So I see this coming because it's inevitable. As much as people say, no, that'll never happen. We're never going to have private sector could never afford to go to space. We could never have a space station. We could never. It's happening right now. It's happening right now, and we're going to be free one way or the other, and libertarianism is going to advocate it or it's not. Well, I want to get some history. And when we come back, Mary Ruart's been in the libertarian movement and the party and Ellen, the Libertarian National Committee and everything. We're going to find out all kinds of stuff from the inside. This is for the archive. You guys stay right there.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Baby, when I think about you, I think about love.
Mary Ruart, I think about love. We're going through a walk down memory lane of the libertarian movement. It's all about the love. Can I have some more love, a little bit of love? Thank you for some love. Now, Mary, I want to get back into the history. I want to go back, and I want to know how it is that you even heard the word libertarian. And it would help me and other people if you're willing to tell me about what year you graduated high school. How old are you?
Well, let's see. I'm 60 years old, so I was in college in the late 60s, and I read about Ayn Rand and objectivism and got very excited about that. And really the thing that convinced me was the recognition that, for example, if somebody was not giving to the poor, that might be selfish, but for me to put a gun to that person's head and take their money forcibly was even less loving. And that was the thing that really convinced me that libertarianism was the right way to go. And then in Reason Magazine, I saw an advertisement for the party and joined back, I think, when it was first formed. But
how long's Reason been around?
Oh, Reason's been around for quite a while. It was founded in the 70s.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And however, I didn't hear anything more from the Libertarian Party. I really didn't get any mailings or acknowledgement or anything. So I then noticed in the mid-70s, there was an advertisement in the Kalamazoo newspaper that there was going to be a meeting of the Libertarians. So I went to that, and I met Cheryl Laux, who had been in the Denver area, and she had, you know, been around in the early years of the party and was quite well-versed in the philosophy. And that's where I really, I think, learned the nuances of what it meant to be a libertarian. I'm forever grateful to her for that education. And, of course, as often happens in the party, she asked me to run for office as a paper candidate. And she said, they've never had any debates for this office, so you don't need to worry. Well, of course, when I ran, it was the first year they had debates. So I was immediately thrown into the fire, and since then have run about another dozen campaigns.
So well, how was your been? What's been your success? I mean, you know, it's more everybody's going to, hey, you just got your 1-3%, blah 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 blah. And I that's just not me. I'm. How many minds did you free? How much impact did you have on even the other candidates? How many people got to hear the message for the first time? What, as the years have gone by, has it grown in understanding? Gotten less, more contentious? I mean, you know, from someone starting early on like that in the 70s and going through to, you know, 30 years later, you give a unique perspective, you know, if you'll give it to us.
Sure. Well, when we were out there in the 70s, we were the only people talking about ending the IRS, ending the drug war, ending the Fed.
Conspiracist!
Yeah.
That's too controversial, man. End the Fed? Oh, you crazy people.
Well, you know, you would think we would have gotten that reaction, but we actually, I think, had a good way of presenting the message. And even if people didn't agree with us, they usually thanked us for giving a reasoned argument for another point of view. In fact, the League of Women Voters, when they finally started inviting us to their debate, said, we're going to invite you guys all the time. You're the only candidates that answer the questions, and you have good reasons for what you say.
You know, that happens a lot, and I can always consider myself one of the youngins. I was in the 20s when I first became associated with libertarians and so on, and as you go through the campaign process, I've been in every election cycle since 1990, you know, running for Secretary of State or County Recorder or Congress or U.S. Senate against McCain or, you know, whatever, you know, the state legislature. I'm just there just being, you know, And what happened was, is you could see every 2 years when you come back for the next race or against same people or you see them in the same, all of a sudden they start using your rhetoric. They don't believe it, but they know how popular it is. People like it. They people go away. They actually learned something. And what's the one thing that you think that your efforts in your campaigns and so on has transferred to the people? They come back a couple of years later, the candidates, the voters, the whatever, with a better understanding of what? What is it that they learn?
Well, I can point to several things. One of the things is I used to campaign. I had three different runs at the same office, the state rep, and always the incumbent won. She was a liberal. And I would, of course, acknowledge her good heart when she wanted to do things like welfare and everything, but would point out that the way it was done was actually detrimental. And I knew this because I was running to people, some of whom were on welfare, and I could see the detrimental effect it had on them. You know, young women would get pregnant in high school, and it was sort of a rite of passage. They knew they'd get their welfare check and be able to establish their own household when they delivered. And so they'd do that. And then they'd find out that that welfare check wasn't enough to support one child, so they'd have the second one to get a little more money, and then a third one to get a little more money, and then in Michigan, that would stop. So by the time they were 21, they had three children. They didn't usually have a high school diploma. They wanted to go to work because they realized that was the only way they were going to get ahead, but they had all this child care to worry about. And, of course, they could barely get an entry-level position. So it was actually... they actually lost money getting their initial job, and they usually just go back on welfare and be caught forever. And so the welfare was really encouraging them to make some bad decisions about planning their life. And they realized that, and I had a lot of discussions with young women like that, and they were very frustrated because unless they had a mother or an aunt or somebody who would watch the kids while they went to work, they were stuck forever in the poverty trap.
Well, what was her response?
So, well, it was interesting. She actually came to me one day. I saw her Kalamazoo. We were both shopping in the same area. She said, you know, I voted for that privatization of welfare bill that came down, and I'm really proud of myself. And it was really a revelation that here I had actually convinced her, you know, that things had to be done outside of the public sector. So it was quite enlightening for me, too, and it taught me that when we are dealing with our so-called opponents, that we really do need to acknowledge their motives oftentimes and help them recognize that what they're trying to do is going to backfire because they're using aggression as their means.
You know, this is a good point I want to bring up. When you're dealing, I was Republican, you know, kind of because I didn't know any better, you know, and I was entranced by, you know, Reagan's effect on my emotional state and, you know, America, MK, America. And it was once I started to realize how the system works, you know, I went independent and challenged all kinds of election laws and all that kind of stuff. And then as time went on later, as producing for Charles Goyette's show, we went over to the Air America affiliate here. And so, of course, we're giving libertarianism to a whole different field we plowed, okay? It's the left, and I got the impression of this. The right is got this sense of I have a moral superiority to people to be able to justify telling them how they should live their life because it's in their best interest, and gosh darn it, I know better, and they're too dumb, and we can force that on them. The left are more the same thing, but for a different reason. It's not like they feel moral superiority as much as they feel a superiority based on their care. We love people. We want them to be, you know, better, so we're going to make them or provide them or take it from these guys that got and redistribute and whatever. But when you take the tactic that you did, out of love, you say, look, you know, I agree with you. We want people to be better. We want people to have a less stressful life, a higher standard of living, blah, 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 blah. All the same things you do. It's just that what you're doing is creating the opposite effect. You know, we want to have sustained improvement in our lives, blah, blah, blah. Here's how. This is why. And they embrace that more, certainly the rank and file, because they're going, okay, I can see the logic and the reasoning, and that's why you get liberal legislators coming up saying, you know, you're right, I did this, I feel better about myself. The problem is that as you start to have that impact throughout the 90s, I saw this happen, throughout the 90s, you would have the rhetoric coming from the left and the right politicians. They would say, yes, I'm libertarian. You can't swing a dead cat now without hitting a politician telling you how libertarian they are, which is why we run against them and go, no, you're not. The reason is because it means something, because they know that in the populace's mind that they understand this kind of this freedom thing. But what has happened when it comes to policy, as they start to try to enact that, there's an entire class of special interest, of lobbyists, that no longer are they able to just sit back and control 3, 4, 5 legislators to do their bidding. They have to run now. Right now in Arizona State Legislature, there it's not just lawyers anymore. It's lawyers that were lobbyists for special interest. These guys have to come in and start forcing their way into positions of power because the infection has gotten to the point to where they have to be in power to advocate directly for whatever it is that they want, because I feel the shift in not just the people, but the people that have to face these people every couple of years. And the meanness, the recalcitrant, the indoctrinated, the locked in, the sold out, the compromised people are taking over legislatures. And I'm going, wow, man, these guys are really bad. And I could see the trend. If you've been in this race, these battles over the years, you can sit there and watch it happen, certainly here in Arizona. So I'm wondering if you kind of, you know, witnessed that, felt it, see it. Is that something that you're aware of?
Well, I've certainly witnessed the way politicians now claim to be libertarian, even if they don't fit the description that we have of our principles. And this has been always the next step. You know, it's actually a badge of success. We have been so successful that people now, instead of poo-pooing us, want to be associated with our name. And the problem, the challenge for us now is to
keep the name.
stay true to that name, because otherwise we will be absorbed in the system in such a way that we will no longer be distinguishable. And it's not that we should criticize people who call themselves libertarians necessarily, but we just need to point out that, you know, when there's a contradiction between how they're presenting the philosophy and what it truly is, because otherwise it will become meaningless, just like liberal used to mean libertarian. And because there was a shift in how it was perceived, it now means something entirely different.
Heck, conservative used to be, at least constitutionalist or something. I don't know what the heck it means now.
Right. Well, right now when we refer to classical liberals, we are talking about libertarians, the term liberal as it was used classically. Now when we talk about liberals today, it's not the same thing. And this is what's going to happen to the word libertarianism if we don't be sure and hold to our standards and make sure people understand what it really is. Frequently, I hear politicians, even in the party, talking about libertarianism without ever referring to the non-aggression principle. And so a listener really doesn't understand the root of where we're coming from. And if they don't understand that, they really don't understand.
Well, define that for us. The non-aggression principle is pretty basic. I mean, let's give it what for?
Yeah, it's really the same thing we learned as children. You don't hit first. You don't steal. You don't defraud or lie about people. And if you do, if you make the mistake of doing that, you make it right again.
You know, that's one thing that I like bumper stickers, man. If you can't say it in a bumper sticker, you're just babbling. You're BSing me. You're setting me up for something. And if you can't just make a fact, then, something else is going on. And the non-aggression principle is very basically a libertarian supporter of the libertarian philosophy does not advocate, okay? Advocate is a very important word. Does not advocate the initiation of force or fraud. Why do they say force and fraud? How are they linked?
Well, if you think about it, if you make a contract with someone to do something, and you agree to perform for a certain price, and they've paid that price and you don't perform, then you've defrauded them. You've broken your contract, you've lied, and you've tricked them basically. And of course, we consider that aggression because it's a way of stealing from somebody, basically.
Yeah, if you can con the little old lady to give you the money, you might as well just took it. it's the same thing. It's force and fraud. So that's very powerful. But a lot of times people that are outside, there's all kinds of efforts to come in to the libertarian movement and try and alter it, but that's way too difficult. I mean, libertarian philosophy is pretty, that's hard. You're up against Facebook and 15 gazillion 24-year-olds, and they're not going to let you do it. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But
well, I don't know, Ernie. I might disagree with you a little bit. I mean, when I campaigned in the last presidential election, of course, I listened to Wayne Allyn Root, and I've read his book, and I really think he is trying to change what we stand for and what we're
as a party. Well, see, that was my point. I wanted you get that. This is, there's two distinctions. For me, when you see the Levolution and you see, the people, they immerse themselves in Austrian economics. And what's amazing, I never understood the term, he's forgotten more than you'll ever know about something. I never understood what that meant. As a young kid, it forgotten more. Was he senile? I don't get it. And then you start to talk to these people that for 2 years have done nothing but read Austrian economics or in college and discuss on Facebook the finer points up back and forth. But it's like the old email list back in the 90s, libertarians. How many libertarians can dance on the head of a pin? I mean, they for years, and they've already forgotten more about Austrian economics than most libertarians know. And I'm going, in the party. So I'm going, you cannot redefine this in such a way that it's going to be winked out or re-represented or whatever. But in the party, that's different. Because it's easier to just get the shiny badge. I'm going to come in and I got shiny badge. I say what it is. And that is going to come directly head to head with what an entire new generation of evolutionaries have defined amongst themselves in peer-to-peer review. And this younger generation, you're not, in my opinion, you are not going to be able to replace what it is in their heads. I don't care how many shiny badges you have. I don't care how much the LP at a national level does. It's not going to happen. And when we come back, we're going to talk about that with Mary because she's worried. She's worried. There's an attack on the party to make it not libertarian. And I'm like, yeah. So, you think it's going to die? Is it can survive it? It wasn't robust to survive anything. I say it is. We're going to find out when we come back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
We will not let our government destroy our humanity. We will not wait another moment in fear to stand up for what we know to be right. It is time we start meeting oppression with resistance. They cannot stop us. Humanity marches on. You can fight it or fight for it. When we say revolution, we say it with love.
And that's the next generation. That's Adam Kokesh running for Congress as a Republican in northern New Mexico at the Revolution March in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 08. And I'll tell you, you know, this next generation has an entire understanding that is kind of got missed by inside the LP. Now, Mary, you were involved quite a bit during the Levolution. In fact, the For Liberty, the Ron Paul documentary, you know, you're featured quite prominently understanding that, hey, you know, these kids, man, they're going to whip our butt. So I want to get your perspective on, you know, you think that, you know, at least the Libertarian Party is under attack. I mean, I can see that because it's kind of, you know, it's got its ballot status. It's got its shiny badges. It's a, you know, someone gets up there and says, I'm head shiny badge. You know, they can say whatever, but I think it's going to be more difficult for them to alter the definition than you think. I mean, but what's your concern?
I certainly do. However, what I've noticed is that there's a, you know, for example, as you know, obviously, you're running for national chair, and Wayne Allyn Root's running for national chair, and he talks about rebranding the LP.
Grouper! Grouper to Chilean sea bass!
That's
We're
right.
We're going to be a Chilean sea bass party!
And I find it, in some ways, I find it kind of amusing, because he has this idea somehow that radicals, and he includes me in that group, go out and talk about legalizing heroin. And yet, if you look at his book, and if you listen to him on the campaign trail, he keeps saying things like, I'm a combination of Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, and Ron Paul on steroids. And I don't think he means it literally, but it certainly, he doesn't deny it either. So, you know, it kind of gives the impression that he's in support of steroids for some reason, which I find a little contradictory. But beyond that, if you read his book, and I'm not recommending it necessarily because it was a difficult read. You know, he has nothing bad to say about conservatives. In fact, the whole chapter where he's explaining what the libertarian model is about conservatives. He talks about Barry Goldwater and how his parents supported the new conservative party, and how he wants to bring back the principles of Barry Goldwater to the American people. So he's defining libertarianism as conservatism. I mean, you can't come away if you're a novice.
He is looking for market share. That's all he's looking for is market share. He's doing this as a salesman.
Well,
he's doing
I would say that, except, Ernie, except throughout the book, he also has nothing good to say about liberals and a lot of good things to say about conservatives. In fact, the liberal comments approach hate speech. I wrote a review in Amazon to do damage control on his book because I felt that any liberal who was interested in the Libertarian Party and read that would be totally turned off.
Well, no liberal is going to be reading it. I mean, you know, I don't see why. He's just a symptom of a much longer, larger problem. You know,
yeah, I would agree.
You know, there's just, I mean, he's a perfect symbol for that. But, you know, but I don't see him as much as a threat as you do. I see him as an education. You know, this is what happens when you don't clearly define libertarianism yourself. Somebody else will define it for you. And if you're afraid of defining it, you're afraid of championing it, you're afraid to oppose the cult of the omnipotent state and go after these guys, if you're not defining yourself by your actions, somebody else will define you.
Well, and that's right. And not only that, the way he's trying to define us is as conservatives, and if anyone was going to vote for a conservative, they'd be voting for a Republican. They'd be voting for the Ron Paul Republicans, Republican Liberty Caucus. So that's what I mean when I say if we're not careful, we'll get absorbed into the mainstream.
Yeah, when we come back, you see where this is going to go. And I'm not so concerned about individuals as I am about the philosophy and where it's going, and more importantly, why. We'll be right back.